everyone, and welcome to your weekly episode on this, the Day of the Dead weekend. It's your final October Spooktacular episode, and it's a new tale, courtesy of Scott Wells, about being a small-town guy in high school messing with energies that he didn't understand. Before I go any further, there is a trigger warning for this episode, because it is intensely spooky and has to do with a Ouija board. But all things being equal, this is also the story of a young man growing up in a Mormon household who is gay and living that life in secret, who ultimately ends up going on his 2 years of service for the Mormon community. As with all lives and all stories, there is both the sweet and the sorrow in Scott's tales. He shares a few stories of magic, of guardian angels, but also tells of his intensely sweet friendship with Rosa Parks, that civil rights icon. I never know what my guests are going to share, but this time, the conversation about Rosa Parks gobsmacked me. Scott shares an intensely personal reflection on Rosa, and it helped me to understand her fortitude, her generosity of spirit, and simply her kindness. So on this Day of the Dead, here is your final spooky installment this October season.
Small town in Idaho. We knew everyone. I knew all the houses. And I'm like, there's no boarded up houses in here. It gave us an address, an actual address. So we went over there and there was a boarded up house there.
How do you self-describe? If you had to go to a conference and get up on stage and introduce yourself to an audience, or even if you're at a party and someone's like, hey, who are you? What do you do? How would you do that?
That's a great question. And I think in different circumstances scenarios, it would change, but it would be not change because I am who I am. But first and foremost, I think when it comes to storytelling and when it comes to who I am at my core is I've learned a long time ago, I'm one of those people that strange things happen to. I grew up in Idaho, in a very conservative, small farming town. I grew up Mormon, and I love the outdoors, and you know, that has been the location of some of my most spiritual experiences that I've ever felt has been outdoors in nature. And you know, it's been outdoors in nature that a lot of these things have happened. And once I get over wow, that really happened to me, or the trauma, or, you know, whatever that experience is, I'm like, wow, this is a great story. And it's been the catalyst of my writing, not only this story, but also the next story that I have coming out in May.
Okay. Yay. I mean, you know, I was, you know, looking at you and I'm thinking we're kind of both the same age. I don't know. Were you a huge X-Files fan when you were growing up?
You know, it's really interesting you ask that. I don't think I've ever watched an episode of X-Files. Bizarre. No, it's shocking, right? I mean, I love the paranormal. I love exploring what you can't explore, you know, or what you can't explain. But I don't know. I think that show came about when I was at a different point in my life. And, you know, there was a period of my life that I was homeless. And, so I believe, if I remember right, this show came out when that was going on. You know, I need to go back and binge watch, because I've never had that question before. But you would think that I would love that show.
Yeah. I mean, I only bring it up because you were saying that you had these kind of, you know, you've had multiple seminal or eerie experiences out in nature that kind of became fodder for your writing. And it just brought to mind so many X-File episodes where they're out in the woods and, dear God, what is that grew from that tree? And
why is it growing from the tree? And why is it killing everybody? And how did this happen? And what do you mean there was like a radioactive accident like 30 miles down the road? And what the heck? So I was thinking, oh my gosh, you must have watched The X-Files, because the monster of the week every once in a while was something that it crept out of the sewers, you know, from the slime and pollution, or like from a radioactive spill, or maybe it was an ancient god that was like a fungus that walked or something that came around. So I was listening to you and thinking that, but I guess you did not. So, well, I'm curious, when you were a kid and you had these experiences, well, maybe even before you had these experiences, did you have this deep sense of the world having maybe another layer underneath reality, or a darkness that we can't see, or even a lightness that we can't see normally?
Yes, is the short answer. So the town that I grew up in, it's again, small farming town. It's in a valley in central Idaho, about 45 minutes away from that town, from my parents' house, was another little town called Albion. It's named Albion, Idaho. And there's an Albion College there that used to be have you heard of it? Yes, it used to be a you know, pretty big thing, and then it closed, and then it opened. And so when I was in junior high, and high school, it was the big thing to drive up to Albion College and sneak in without the caretaker seeing us. And there were times, I was there one time, and this was probably, I want to say 14, maybe 15. It was before this experience happened. And it was me and three of my friends, and we went into the gym, and, you know, the bats flew out, of course, scared us to death. And but we got down to the theater, and this was the first time I had come across something that might be a layer to the other side. And that college hadn't been used in my lifetime, as far as I knew. Yet spread all over the ground were that night we were there were production they hand them out as a cast and everything, but they were spread out all over the ground, and then the date on that was the day before. Most of the chairs were missing. The chairs that were there were bent. They were ripped. They were shredded. And I just remember what I looked down and picked it up off the floor. It was a program that was dated the night before. And I thought, oh, all right, something's definitely going on here. And I don't know. In the past, I'm like, I want proof. And so I thought, oh, someone's playing a joke. You know, someone, you know, kids come up here all the time. So they thought, let's do this. And I don't know if that's the case. With my experience with the book, with Marked by the Ouija, when I actually had that experience, it was very similar. I didn't believe it. I didn't think that it could happen, but I'd heard all of the stories. And I tell you, within 12 hours, I was a believer.
You know, I'm intrigued by this. Do you think that these things happen around you because you're a believer and because you want to see them?
You know, that's a really, really good question that I've thought about for years, internally. I've went back and forth for years with the question of even with this experience, after this experience and after the Albion College experience, I still went back and forth, like, is there life after death? Is there something afterward? You know, because I want proof. You know, I was one of those people, and I struggled with that. You know, and my opinion and belief has changed over time with the different experiences in life that I've had. And, you know, I lost one of my dogs. She was with me for over 16 years, and she was a soulmate. I mean, we were both soulmates of each other, and that was absolutely devastating. And I thought for sure that if there was life after death, then she would find a way to come back and let me know she was okay. And my mom died a year ago last week. And, you know, she and I had conversations about this as well. And, you know, so there have been several, you know, people that my sister-in-law that I actually dedicated the book to, she passed away in March. And, you know, so I've went from not believing that there's an afterlife to believing, to not believing, to believing. I've come to the conclusion internally for myself that I don't completely understand it, but I do believe without a doubt that there is something. I mean, and I believe that the other side of that veil wants to connect with us in every way possible for whatever reason. I think there's, you know, some spirits can be asking for help, which was my case. And we didn't listen. And it turned, I lost my friend because of that. You know, so I think that where I don't completely understand it, I do believe that there's something after. And that question of, am I listening to it? Am I in tune to it? That's something that I think about all the time. You know, I've tried to be more in tune and pay closer attention to it. And then at times I get wrapped up in life. I have a trade show and event business, and, you know, so that I started over 20 years ago. So, you know, you get wrapped up in life and you tend to not be in tune with nature. And so I find myself in that constant roller coaster motion of, you know, wanting to and feeling like I'm in tune to getting wrapped up in everything else and having to recenter myself, I guess, if that makes any sense.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. 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 Well, yeah, absolutely. You know, you've said, you know, you're an author. Okay. We know that you're an author, and now you've told us about your business that you do. However, I'm curious, as a kid, what did you dream of becoming?
I love that question. I love that. The first thing that pops into my head is I thought for sure that I was going to be the next Howard Jones. I had, you know, my hair, I had the Flock of Seagulls haircut, I had the, you know, color, and then Jon Bon Jovi, you know. But thinking back, and when I wrote this book and when I started really getting into writing, you know, I wrote the screenplay of the other, and I'm adapting it to a book now. I remembered that when I was eight, I set a goal that I wanted at some point, I wanted to write something that was published. And when I was, it only took 38 years to do it. Actually, it took longer than that to do it, but I finally did it. And I remember when I was, I was probably 22 or 23, I wrote an article for a magazine, and I sent it to them hoping that they would publish it. It was an article about the overwhelmingly high suicide rate for gay youth in the Mormon church. I wanted to bring attention to that. So I did some research. And plus, at the time, I had also volunteered on some suicide hotlines and things. And so, I just wanted to do that. And it didn't happen. So I'm thankful that I did this. But now that I've actually written a book and I've written a screenplay and all of this is going, I mean, you had talked about creativity earlier. I love the creativity. I love being able to share my stories and see the reaction and the response that people get. And it's very important to me that my stories are authentic and they're accurate. I'm very adamant that what I write, I want to be true, as true as possible and as authentic as possible. And I want people to learn from it. You know, that's important for me.
I love that. And you actually created a fabulous segue into my second question of the podcast, which is, did you grow up in a religious household, which you've kind of already said, but so did you grow up in a religious household? What was that like? And as you've gotten older and matured, how has that connection to the divine or that connection to what we cannot see evolved over time?
So you are just full of great questions, and I love it. I respect this. It's great. So yes, I grew up in a Mormon household. And, you know, I went on my mission when I was 19, and I was the only one from my immediate family that did it. My mom, she'd always wanted a missionary. And so I finally, the youngest, the last one, finally did it. And I went to Detroit, and I had a life-changing experience in so many different ways. I mean, it taught me my work ethic. It taught me how to talk to people when sometimes they don't want to talk to you. You know, you have to have that thick skin. I also believe things happen for a reason. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that will always be one of the most sacred, experiences of my life is on my mission, I got to know Rosa Parks really, really well. Yeah. Yeah.
She's. What?
Yeah. Yeah. I would sit, I still get goosebumps. I would sit on her front porch every Tuesday for an hour for 6 months. And we would just talk. And I didn't know who she was. I knew that she was somebody because we had to take Rosa Parks Boulevard to get to her house. But what she's known for happened before I was born. And they didn't teach that in rural Idaho. So I wish I could go back and ask her. I have a million questions I'd like to ask, but you know, but then again, maybe that's what made it so special is because I didn't, it was just my companion and I and her having a human conversation, just two people or three people just talking about life and family and what we want to be when we grow up. And it was, it's always been and will always be one of the most prized and, you know, sacred experiences of my life. I have a show, a trade show every year in Detroit. And I just got back from there, as a matter of fact, about a week ago. And about 4 years ago, I decided that I was going to go in early and I was going to go to Woodlawn Cemetery and pay my respects to her. And I went there and couldn't find her grave. I found Aretha Franklin's grave. I found the Four Tops grave. I found, you know, a lot of other people. I couldn't find her space. So I went to the management office, the facilities office, and asked, you know, I said, I'd like to pay my respects. And they're like, you're not family with Miss Parks. And we don't give out her location. And I mean, they had a map where everyone else was, you know, where Aretha Franklin was, and I went and paid my respects, but not with Rosa Parks. So she said, well, why do you want, you know, and so I told her my story. And by the time I finished, she was crying. And she said, you know what, I still get a little emotional with this because it was, she said, you know what, I think Miss Parks would want you. And she said, that building right over there is her building. And it was the first building when you go in, but there's no markings or anything. And it's a key code. And she gave me the key code to get in. And so I was able to go in and spend 45 minutes in there. And I told her everything I wanted to share with her, how much her that experience with her has helped shape my passion for helping other people. And again, you know, when I got these death threats, you know, I thought of Rosa Parks as well. And I thought, you know what? Sometimes we all have to stand up for the good in life and stand up for people who don't have a voice. And I told her, I said, she taught me that. I mean, there were so many great things. Like, it was important to her that she buy us an ice cream cone. And the ice cream, that's a cool little story about her. It really shows her character. But the ice cream truck always came by at the same time. And whenever we were there, without fail. And we were teaching the lady next to her. And one time the appointment went a little bit long. And by the time we got out, the ice cream truck had moved on. And she, Ms. Parks, Rosa Parks, was standing out there with a dollar in each hand. And she said, I couldn't hold it here. Get on your bikes and catch up with him. So we caught up with him. And about 3 weeks later, we were back and our appointment went a little bit longer as well. And we were standing on her next door neighbor's porch. And with the lady that we were talking to was looking over our shoulder, and we could hear the ice cream truck in the back. And I remember seeing the lady's eyes, and finally she stopped us and she said, I'm sorry. She's like, you boys need to go. Miss Parks is waiting for you. And I turned around. I'm not embellishing this. The ice cream truck was right here. She was standing in front of it. It backed up and went around it, and she moved over. It backed up and went around. She's like, you're not leaving. She told the driver, you're not leaving until I buy my boys some ice cream.
Thank you for all of that, because my heart was just getting so excited and happy hearing these beautiful, powerful stories, because I was thinking about you going on your mission, and you brought up the death threats too. So we'll get to that in a couple of minutes. But, you know, here you are. You're the youngest. You get sent off on your mission. It's 2 years somewhere where you've never been before. It's lonely. It's isolating. No family. Maybe one friend if you get along with the other, your partner. And you have to basically go out into the world and talk to complete strangers who might not want to talk to you, who might not be the nicest person to you. I can't imagine the isolation and loneliness. I would have been terrified, because I hate going up to people I don't know and talking to them. So first, I'm just like, I don't even know how you did that. But then to find this woman who is so lovely and so solicitous and so kind, kindness itself, and thoughtfulness and sweetness and just love. And then you spend Tuesdays with her. And I mean, you just had to have, you looked forward to that part of the week, I'm sure.
Absolutely. I remember, we would turn off Rosa Parks Boulevard, and her house was about two blocks down on the right. And her front porch it was a big front porch, and she had a swing as you're facing it. She had a swing over to the right. And then when you walked up the stairs to the middle, to the door, there were these two big white columns that kind of flanked both sides of the stairs going up. And I remember, many times we would turn left off Rosa Parks Boulevard, and as soon as, you know, of course, I'd look right for her house, and she would be hanging on that column, leaning out, waiting for us to turn the corner. And as soon as she would see us, she'd just start waving. And it was just, I looked forward to it every week. And you know, there were on my mission, you know, I had several companions, and in that particular area, you know, every so often they switched out, you know, your companion. So I had the great pleasure of introducing at least two other of my companions to her as well. And just, I mean, never in a million years would I have thought it would be even a remote possibility to run into her, you know, and going to Detroit from a small town in Idaho where there was no diversity. It was terrifying. I mean, there was one time we were going to her house, we were passing a school that was on Rosa Parks Boulevard, and they were rioting. And about a block before, my companion and I stopped and I was training him. And he's like, we were going to go around, right? And I'm like, nope, we're going to go right through it. So we tucked our pant leg that was on the chain side into our sock. And I said, don't make eye contact, just go straight through and go right as fast as you can. So as we start going, and I mean, they were trying to tip a car over. They were, it was mayhem. And we went right through, and I broke my rule. And I happened to look over because there was a somebody right not too far from me. And I kind of moved over to miss him. And I met, we locked eyes. And I hear, get him. And next thing I know, there were rocks that were coming all around us. And that was about two blocks before we turned left to go down to her house. But you know, that, you know, it was just something, that environment was something that I was never exposed to, you know, so it taught me a lot. It taught me to stand up for it. And my mom was, as always, taught me to stand up for what you believe in, even if it's not the most important opinion. And, you know, so, you know, that experience was even though I'm no longer a part of that church, that experience will always be something very monumental in my personal growth, you know, and teaching me who I want to be as a human.
Oh my gosh. Yes. And Rosa modeled that for you too. I mean, I just love that image of her standoff with the ice cream truck. It's totally hilarious. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm going to ask this question early because this is a big question for you. It's the main question of my podcast, and I suspect we will have a lot to talk about around it. But you know, the main question is, I would love for you to share a story of something miraculous, magical, or mysterious that has happened in your life. And we already know that you've had a lot of things happen. I don't know if you want to discuss what happened with the Ouija board, that incident, but whatever you'd like to share.
Yes, I'll share a couple of, you know, things about the story as well. But there are several things or experiences that I can think back to my life that I would consider magical or blessings, or I don't understand them, but I'm sure thankful that I had them. I believe that from my experience with this book, I mean, when I had the experience, I went through several years where I just felt so guilty. And because it was my board, it was my game, but it was my friend who lost his life. And I thought, I just felt guilty about that. And as a result of that, I think I went into a time in my life, a dark time in my life, where I made bad decisions. And that I ended up homeless, and I didn't know what to do. You know, I was lost. I wasn't completely homeless, so I lived in my car. And my friends and my family didn't know that I lived out of my car. I was able to, I did have a job, and I would go in early and shower there. They had a shower there. But when everyone else, you know, especially on weekends, you know, come over and watch a movie or whatever, you know, or I was dating somebody, I started dating someone during this period. And so he always wondered, well, why do we always go to my place? And I'm thinking, because mine's parked on the curb. But it was a white Geo Metro. And if you remember those, and my friends used to call it the girl skate, because all the girl roller skates were white. And they're like, it's about the size of a girl skate. But there were times when, I mean, I had no money, and the stress and the anxiety of how I'm going to get by and how I'm going to even make it to work without any money for gas. And one of the things that I did, I was living in Atlanta at the time, and around Atlanta, they have 285, which goes around the city. And one of the ways that I could blow off steam and think was to drive as fast as I can without, you know, getting caught for speeding, with all my windows rolled down, with the music up loud. And I was doing this one night, you know, and, you know, I was going to have to find a place to park it and sleep, you know, in the car. And I realized that I was almost at gas. And I just happened to be in a part of town that was very dangerous. And it was nighttime. It was about, it was probably getting close to 10. And I had $2.17 on me. And that's all I had. And so I need gas. I can't park it here. I wasn't going to be able to eat that night, you know, obviously. So I took the exit. And when I took the exit coming up to the main street, my car died. It ran out of gas. And I was literally two car lengths from the stop sign. And I could see, you know, up the stop sign, you turn left and go over the overpass. And I could see a gas station there. But I was terrified to get out of my car because of the neighborhood. And over to the right, a couple blocks down, I saw a group of guys that were heading my way, and they were loud, and they were just the way what they were doing, you know, clearly they were up to no good. And I didn't want to be there when they got there, but I couldn't move. You know, I couldn't move the car, and I didn't have time to run over and find something to put gas in and come back. Well, right where I was parked on the left, there's the freeway, and I took the exit, and in between the road I was on and the freeway, there was a row of bushes or trees, I guess you can say, shrubs. They were really tall, and it was dark, and I'm watching these guys come closer. I can see the gas station, and I'm terrified. And all of a sudden, a man walks out of the darkness of these trees and comes right up to my window. And I'm going to die. You know, this is how I die. And he said, I will go get you some gas. Give me the money you have, and I will get you some gas. And he was not threatening, but when he said, give me the money you have, to me, I took it, you know, because I'm already in that mode anyway. And I rolled the window down just a little bit and pushed the money out. And I'm just, take it. I mean, go, don't hurt me. And he went over and got some gas and brought it back to me. He brought $2.17 back to me. Before those kids, they, by this point, by the time they came, he even put the gas in my car so I wouldn't need to get out. And those kids at this point were about a half a block away. And I remember I heard the gas can or the, you know, the flap close. And I looked over to see where these kids were. And I looked back and the guy was gone. He had just disappeared. And I thought he went back into the bushes, but I mean, literally it was seconds. And so I was able to get out of there and go find a safe space to, you know, to park and sleep for the night. But there's no doubt in my mind that, and I can't explain it, but if there's such a thing as a guardian angel, it was that man. So with the story, so I was 16. I bought this this board, and I had it in my bedroom. And, you know, even after the Albion College experience and the experience that I just mentioned about, you know, running out of gas, that happened afterward. But even with that, I still can't say I believed it. I heard the stories, but I'm like, you know, I love being scared, and, you know, I love not completely understanding everything, because I love the mind and it makes my mind expand and look at new options or new things. But my friends were waiting for me to get off work and we were going to go do something, but I ended up working later, quite a bit later than expected. And so they were bored and dug around in my room and found the board. And so they decided to play it. I wasn't there. I was at work, but I got a call at work and they were frantic. I don't even think comes close to explaining it. They explained that they had, that they found the board in my bedroom and they decided to play it, you know, because they were bored. And they told me about what happened, about their personal experience. And it scared them so much that they took my board and they burned it with lighter fluid in a garbage can in my backyard. I was so annoyed. I was, I think I was more annoyed or angry that they got to play with it before I did. So I got home from work that night about midnight. And as I'm walking up to the back door, I could smell the lighter fluid. I mean, it just lingers in the air, so I could smell it. And when I got to the garbage can, I saw the ash in there. There were still some embers. It was still smoldering a little bit. And there were, you know, the garbage can was up against the house and it was a white house and there was even smoke marks that went up. So that fire must have been pretty big. And, I'm like, well, there's nothing I can do. So I went in and I had school the next morning. So I walked out the next morning to go to school and the lighter fluid scent was gone, which, you know, didn't surprise me. All of the ash was gone. The smoke marks on the side of the house were gone. And sitting on top of the garbage can was a brand new Ouija board in its box. And this was probably about 7 o'clock in the morning. I got home at midnight the night before. So I'm like, my bedroom was on the other side of that wall. So I'm like, that's a pretty good prank for these guys to come back and clean all this up so quietly, like they're ninjas, and me not hearing it from the other side of the wall. And so I went to school, I threw it in my room, went to school. And I saw them in the hall. And when I walked up to them and I started to say, wow, that was the prank of the year. And they saw me and stopped me and said, stay away from us. We don't want anything to do with you. And to this day, they don't want anything to do with me. Their experience scared them so much that it affected, you know, our friendship, obviously, but it also, I don't know how it's affected them long term, but I know that it probably has. So I turned around to some other friends of mine and I'm like, can you believe that? I'm like, it was a joke. It was a great joke. I don't know why they're acting like that. But they decided that they wanted to play it. And I'm like, great, you know, I'm off on Sunday. So they came over to my house. And in the book, it is Trent and Darcy. It's brother and sister. To protect the people involved, I had to change the names and, you know, some of the things there. But otherwise, everything's true. So, but in the book, it's Trent and Darcy. And Trent was the main one. In real life, it was two brothers. So they came over on Sunday. They lived two doors down from me. And for 12 hours, it lasted 12 hours. We were talking to this guy who said his name was Peter. He said he was 16 when he died, and he died in a car accident. You know, of course, you know, we started asking him all the questions. I thought it was odd that every time I asked a question, or every time one of the other brothers, or in the book it's Darcy, asked the question, and there was no response. The board only responded when Trent asked the question. So we would ask a question and nothing would happen. Trent would ask it and it would answer. And we thought, oh, that's weird, odd. But we didn't think too much of it. Well, He immediately shut off, not Peter, the one we're talking to, immediately shut off the us asking him any questions. And he said, my sister has been kidnapped. She's bound and gagged in this boarded up house, and you have to save her. And for like, we're 16. I mean, we're not the Hardy Boys. We don't know what's going on. And so I'm like, there's no, I mean, again, small town in Idaho. We knew everyone. I knew all the houses. And I'm like, there's no boarded up houses in here. It gave us an address, an actual address. So we went over there, and there was a boarded up house there. And so we, you know, we tried to pull the boards off. We called out, you know, he said his sister's name was Chastity. We called out his sister, we called out Chastity's name. We listened for any noise. We did everything we could, you know, to see if someone was in there. And then we went back, nothing, we couldn't find anything. So we went back, and as soon as we went back and, you know, put our fingers on the planchette again, I was the scribe. I didn't actually have my fingers on the planchette. The other two did. But as soon as they put their fingers on the planchette, it started moving. And said, she's there. She's there. Go back. You have to go back now. So we're like, oh, it's weird. Let's go back. So we went back and forth several times. Each time it was getting darker. I mean, this lasted all throughout the night. At one point, we're back and it was nighttime, and a car came by, driving by really slowly. And I don't remember which one of us, but it said, if this is true, what if that's the kidnapper killer? And I kind of pass it off as it's a neighbor thinking that, you know, there's kids vandalizing the house. But either way, we hid, and this lasted all night long. Finally, we went back the last time that we utilized the board, and I'll use the name Trent because that's the book, the name in the book. The board said, if you don't help my sister Trent, actually use my friend's name, Trent, then you will die the same way I died. And so we freaked out, and we thought, well, all right, we've been over there for the last, at this point, 12 hours, and actually it was over 12 hours, and we didn't find anything. So let's see if we can corroborate Peter's story by going to the local newspaper office and looking. And we spent 2 hours in their microfiche room searching all obituaries for a 16-year-old boy named Peter that died in a car accident. And we thought, if we could verify that, then this is right. This is true. And we need to take it, this threat to Trent, more seriously. But if we don't find it, then it's fake and we just can't explain it, you know? And we didn't find anything. And so two of us were excited, woo, you know, it's fake. But Trent stayed quiet the whole time, and which is not like him. He laughed a lot, and he was, you know, he was on the football team, and, you know, and all of a sudden he said, well, we didn't ask Peter if he died here in this town, which is true, we didn't. And so if he hadn't died there, he wouldn't be in that paper. So we went to the sheriff. I'm like, let's go to the sheriff. And the sheriff didn't believe us. Basically, he knew my parents, and he's like, I'm going to take you to school in my cruiser, and then I'm going to call your dad, and, you know, he's going to beat your butt, you know, and he would have. So kind of just let it go. About 10 years later, we graduated high school. About 10 years later, I was home visiting my mom, my parents, and my mom saved all of the cards and, you know, stories that I wrote from second grade on, and, you know, Mother's Day cards are made for her. And so I was going through that drawer, and I got to the end, and I noticed that there was some paper sticking out underneath the bottom of the drawer, like someone had taken the drawer out, hidden something there, and put it back in. And over time, it kind of worked its way out. So I pulled the drawer out and I read it, and it was all of my notes from this experience. And I had stapled them. And I read through everything, and you know, it was a weird experience. So I had heard that Trent and Darcy were in town visiting their parents. So I went over to their house and Darcy answered. And I said, we kind of caught up. I'm like, well, where's Trent? I leave town. I'm going back home tomorrow. So I'd like to, you know, catch up with him. And she's like, oh, you didn't hear. I said, no. And she said, well, Trent died. I said, how did he die? And she's like, he died in a car accident. And I've told this story thousands of times and I still get goosebumps all over. And I had just read those notes an hour before. And I said, when did he die? And she said, it was a brother. He said, it's a day I'll never forget. And he said, he told me the date. And it was exactly 2 years to the date that threat came through the board. But that stunned me. And I said, do you remember that experience we had playing with the Ouija board? And Darcy's jaw dropped and she said, she remembered. And she said, you know what? That house burned down too. There was no body ever found at the house, at least that was reported. So the book actually, it goes into detail about my friend's experience and what they experienced and my experience. And, you know, of course, the aftermath of it doesn't talk about the aftermath of my guilt and everything. But when I was writing this, I realized it hit me why Trent lost his life. There was a reason that he was marked, which is the title of the book, Marked by the Ouija. There's a reason that he is marked. When I learned that, I realized that could really help with the guilt. And I realized I don't, it's not me. It's not my fault. And I shouldn't feel guilty. I still can't believe it.
And that's it. That is Scott Wells wrapping up our October Spooktacular season. Scott is a best-selling thriller and YA, and that means young adult, horror author, and a killer Nashville Claymore Award finalist. As he stated, he was raised Mormon in a deeply sheltered world and taught to fear his own identity and ignore anything deemed unexplainable. When Scott came out, he almost lost everything. His family, his faith, and of course, as he says, his stability. So Scott did what so many do. He began to rebuild his life from the inside out. And what saved him was writing. What saved him was story. And so if you want to check out his book, Marked by the Ouija, please, there will be a link in the episode show notes. Just click on it, and it'll take you right to where you can purchase that book. There will also be a link to Scott's website. So do yourself a favor and do a deeper dive into Scott's world. I'm so grateful to Scott for sharing his story and being so vulnerable, especially about what it was like to grow up in his family and kind of the expectations and constraints that he had to kind of operate under until he could excavate his true self later in life. The story about the Ouija board is indeed terrifying, and I think illustrates what it means when we talk about the Day of the Dead and this weekend, that our ancestors and our loved ones, and even spirits we don't expect, are far closer than we could ever hope to understand. I've always loved this weekend and the celebration of spirit, the celebration of those who have gone before, the ones that we love, the ones that are still in our hearts. So do remember this weekend when you think of someone you hold dear, that maybe they're standing right next to you. Thank you for listening, and here's my one request. Be like Scott. Scott lives in the mystery, in the mayhem, in the mischief of what is unexplained, of what is inexplicable. He knows that this life is full of mystery and magic and guardian angels and miracles. And so he lives an enchanted life. Everything is possibility. So be like Scott and embrace the unknown. Embrace the mystery and embrace the idea that maybe life's a whole lot more fun and a whole lot more interesting when we actually embrace the inexplicable. And that brings to a finish our October spooktacular season. I hope you've enjoyed all these ghostly tales, some old and some new. So I'll see you next year for the next round of scary stories, of spooky tales, because I have a feeling, living in the mystery, that there are a whole lot more tales out there.